Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest in the OIES podcast series. My name is James Henderson, and I'm chairman of the gas programme at OIES. Today, which is the 3rd of August, we are publishing our gas quarterly, which is going to be looking at Russian gas flows into Europe, that perennial topic, but also, importantly, we're also having a feature on China and what's going on with the gas market there, which is clearly going to have a huge impact on the purchasing consumption of LNG, and that will have an impact on Europe as well. So an important topic there, and with me to discuss these things are two of the co-authors of the quarterly. I've got Jack Sharples, as usual, and I've also got Mikhail Maidan, who's director of the gas programme. Mike Fullwood is on holiday this week, but for his fans, he'll definitely be back next week to discuss more on the global LNG market. But for the time being, the three of us will discuss the quarterly. And Jack, I'd like to come to you first, if I may. As usual, the quarterly starts with a couple of graphs on prices. And what, well, both are actually very interesting. The first one I'd like to come to you on is our LNG margins graph, which, as you discuss in the quarterly, has moved from being one with an axis where the peak was at about 10 to one with an axis where the peak's at about 60 or 70 now, as we see LNG margins in the Gulf Coast going through the roof. Can you talk a little bit about that graph, and in particular what impact it's having on potential developers of LNG projects, and whether we see these huge margins actually creating a reaction in the market?
Well, I think first and foremost, we are seeing truly exceptional hub prices in northwestern Europe at the moment. So again, as part of the date stamping, yesterday TTF front month finished the day, closed the day at 208 euros per megawatt hour. So that is just below the peak that we saw in the immediate aftermath of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, when we briefly touched 215. Now the forward prices are looking very strong, to put it mildly, not only through the rest of this year, but also into 2023, and then with a gradual sort of phasing down, let's say, into 2024, 2025. But the key point is that those forward prices do still suggest an incredibly high margin for the next couple of years, so implying really a continued tightness on the global LNG market through into 2025. That in turn looks very healthy from the perspective of anybody that's looking to take FID on an LNG export project. The only caveat that Mike and I really always put in the gas quarterly when we discuss these margins, though, is of course these projects tend to require long-term contracts for offtake. And the big question that remains really in Europe is whether European counterparties are willing to enter into long-term contracts, particularly anything sort of in the 10 to 15 year range.
And is there any sign yet that they are? I mean, there's been a few conversations, haven't they, with the Qataris, and there appears to be a few conversations with US LNG developers as well. Has there been anything to suggest that we are moving in that direction?
I think we are moving in that direction, but I think the key sort of caveat here really is the flexibility that could be embedded into these contracts. As long as European off-takers have the flexibility to trade away their volumes and resell them into other markets, should the demand dry up here in Europe, then I think that would underpin their ability to sign those contracts. I think the other thing to remember as well is that the future of the progress on European gas demand, reducing demand for fossil fuels, progress with the energy transition remains highly uncertain. So, you know, the pushing of gas out of power generation might be the low-hanging fruit with the build-out of renewables. But as we've discussed in other OIS research conducted by my colleagues, decarbonisation in other sectors is much harder to achieve. Now, given the geopolitical context of trying to push Russian gas out as quickly as possible, then I think that there probably still remains a substantial market for LNG coming into Europe for the next decade. It's just that we may be right now in a bit of a window of opportunity, because if you wait until later into the 2020s to sign a long-term contract, then you could get locked into committing to volumes through into the later 2030s, when we really would see, hopefully, a substantial decline in European fossil fuel consumption.
Okay, that's interesting. Thanks. I mean, the other graph that I mentioned is on the flip side, on the more on the demand side. And it shows gas prices relative to coal prices with the carbon price taken into account. And it shows how essentially gas was very competitive with coal for a significant period of time up until really mid-2021. And then since then, gas has become more expensive, even with a rising carbon price. What do you see as the impact of that? Are we starting to see those higher gas prices having an impact on demand? And if so, in which sectors?
Well, I think first and foremost, the competition between coal and gas naturally is in power generation. Here, what we are seeing is, gas to coal switching where possible. But I don't think this is taking place really in a context of plentiful supply of gas and it being a price-driven choice. I think, if anything, this is taking place in a context of constrained supply to the European market, particularly from Russia, and, you know, putting that together with the political impetus, let's say, to put as much into storage as we can before the winter. And so once we get into the winter, it's not going to be really so much a case of gas versus coal, but a question of gas that we have and coal at the same time, if that rather makes sense. Having said that, yes, as the graph that we have in the quarterly shows, that even taking into account carbon prices at sort of $75 to $80 a ton, the exceptionally high gas prices do make coal very competitive where switching is possible.
Okay, I mean, you've talked about the potential constraints in the winter, so let's get on to that. I mean, for those who are interested, we have done a specific podcast on the issues surrounding Nord Stream 1 and the compressors and Canadian sanctions. So we're not going to go into that detail here. But Jack, talk to me a little bit about the routes for Russian gas. I mean, Yamal has been empty for a while now. Any sign of that situation changing?
The flows are not coming back on Yamal. The pipeline remains under sanction by the Russian government. Gazprom won't use it. Sadly, that route is not going to be coming back into play.
Okay, so we've got a big zero there. Let's talk about Ukraine then. I mean, flows have come down. You've written about some of the issues there. Can you just sort of give us the latest numbers on the Ukraine route?
Yeah, so the flow of Russian gas into Ukraine on Ukraine's eastern border is just over 40 million cubic meters per day. And then what's coming out on Ukraine's western border to Slovakia is closer to about 36 million cubic meters a day, maybe 37. And the difference is what Gazprom supplies to Moldova. So that is obviously significantly lower than the 110 million cubic meters per day transit capacity that Gazprom has. That transit capacity is effectively reduced by the closure of one of the two cross-border interconnections from Russia into Ukraine. So what we effectively have access to at the moment is about 77 million cubic meters per day. So the conclusion here is that there is scope to raise flows via Ukraine should Gazprom choose to do so.
But they haven't, and that's a kind of an interesting conclusion from a couple of the pieces of research you've written lately. And one of the reasons why, of course, they might want to increase the flows on Ukraine is because flows on Nord Stream, as you've documented so well, have been going down. So what's the latest as of today? And I'll say again, it's the 3rd of August. What's the latest today with compressors going in and out of the pipeline?
Well, when we recorded our last podcast on the 26th of July, it was actually the day after that the flow on Nord Stream dipped when one of the two remaining turbines at the Portovaya compressor station was taken offline. By the 28th of July, the flow had dipped to around 32 million cubic meters per day and sat at that level until it dropped again slightly to 30 million cubic meters a day on the 31st of July. Now, for context, the nameplate capacity of Nord Stream is about 165 million cubic meters per day when all compressors are there and in place. So at the moment, we have one compressor in operation. We've got one that is supposedly on its way back from Canada to Russia, but it seems to be held up in dispute between Gazprom and Siemens Energy. What we're looking at going ahead is when that final compressor, that final turbine, needs to be taken offline for its maintenance, and whether the turbine that's currently making its way back from Canada will be reinstalled. This is something that could happen as early as the first half of August. We are simply watching and waiting with bated breath.
And as I gather from the quarterly, essentially we're in a situation now where we're going to be watching compressors and the maintenance sort of periods and potential complaints and transport issues for the foreseeable future, are we? When we've got another 5 or 6 compressors to go and we're just not clear at all how they're going to be moved around?
Absolutely. So given that the first turbine that's been serviced still hasn't been returned and reinstalled, we can only speculate as to how long it's going to take to remove and service and then return and reinstall all of the remaining turbines. So my take on this is that I certainly don't expect flows on Nord Stream to ramp up again anytime during the summer, and we could potentially see those flows constrained right through into the early part of winter.
Okay, well, we'll come on to the early part of winter in a second. But, I mean, the other thing just to briefly touch on is that Gazprom appears to have given up completely any other forms of trading gas in Europe. It's, you know, you mentioned its subsidiaries that it's kind of given up control of, and you've talked a little bit in the past about the electronic sales platform. That's all kind of at zero as well now, yes?
That is, yes. So, you know, the German regulator now effectively has control over Gazprom Germania. Gazprom's not participating in any of its downstream European former subsidiaries. They're not trading on the ESP, so they're only delivering what is nominated under long-term contracts. And in fact, they're not even delivering all of that. On the 14th of July, as we covered in previous podcasts, they declared force majeure on some of their deliveries via Nord Stream, backdating retroactively to the 14th of June. So yeah, we're at substantially lower levels of Russian supply.
Okay, so in the quarterly, you kind of put that lower level of supply together with other kind of non-Russian sources of supply. Let's talk through those a little bit, and also the conclusions you reached about implied consumption in Europe. Can you just give us your thoughts on what's happening to European consumption based on what you can see from all the sources of supply you look at?
So if we put together production, LNG imports, pipeline imports from Russia, Norway, North Africa, and Azerbaijan, and put that together as gross supply, if you like, before we start discussing storage movements, then in the year to date, so from the 1st of January to the 31st of July, this gross supply of gas, if you like, has declined by about 1.2 BCM year on year, from 276.7 to 275.5 BCM. So that's really a very modest drop, considering the way that the market has tightened and prices have risen so substantially. But of course, what's a key factor here is storage movements. So in the period January to July last year, we actually had a net withdrawal from storage of just over 18 BCM, whereas in the period January to July 2022, we've had a net injection of about 16.4 BCM. So that's created a huge swing, if you like. And so as a result, total supply is probably about 35 BCM lower in 2022 than it was in the same period in 2021. And so that is really the sign of a much tighter market.
And just in percentage terms, that's 35 BCM over about 275. So we're talking sort of 12 to 15%.
Total implied European consumption, so that's all the sources of supply plus net storage withdrawals, in January to July 2021, that was about 295 BCM. Now we're down to about 259.
Interestingly, you know, we're kind of moving towards this potential reduced gas consumption target that the EU have set out, and which you talk about in the quarterly as well. I mean, the EU have asked for everyone to be thinking about cutting consumption by 15% this winter. Can you relate that, or tell us a little bit more about that and relate that to what you've seen so far this year?
Well, I think first and foremost, we need to be clear that the EU plans for reduced consumption. What they ask for is a voluntary target of a 15% reduction in demand in consumption between the 1st of August and the 31st of March, so effectively through the winter, compared to average winter consumption of the previous 5 years. But of course, it was initially intended that this would be across the board. This would be a whole EU endeavour. But there are carve-outs and caveats. So those EU member states that don't have pipeline connections with neighbours, such as Cyprus, those that have only limited pipeline connections with neighbours and are already using those at full capacity. So thinking of the connection between Spain and France, and then also those markets that use a lot of gas in power generation but are not connected to the European power grid. So that's Poland and the Baltic states. So what we'll be left with is a voluntary target to reduce demand in those states that are, by and large, the ones that are heavily dependent on Russian gas. So given that we're seeing constrained flows from Russia in any case and very high prices that is also impacting demand, I think that this voluntary target to reduce consumption is something that is going to be happening anyway through just market mechanisms, if you like, but it gives an added political incentive for member state governments to put in place additional policies. So we've seen, for example, in Germany, turning off streetlights or turning off lighting of public buildings at night, those kind of things, or, you know, reducing the temperature of the water in public swimming pools, in the showers, you know, those kind of things. So this is definitely having sort of a psychological impact. It's preparing Europe for a winter when supply might be constrained.
Interestingly, though, it's been interesting to watch, hasn't it, how it is doing that, but it's also creating sort of certain rifts as some countries kind of agree to cut consumption, others not wanting to comply with the EU voluntary kind of request. I guess questions about the solidarity of the EU, particularly if we have a cold winter.
Yes, absolutely. The proof will be in the pudding. If we hit midwinter and suddenly, even the relatively low levels of Russian supply that we have at present are curtailed even further, or if we just simply hit the middle of a very cold winter, we could find ourselves back in a situation that we saw. You know, there's a parallel with vaccines during COVID, where actually you start to see some member states trying to, you know, prioritize their own need and not cooperate so closely with their neighbours. So we simply have to wait and see.
And as we wait and see, I guess we've got to think about those other non-Russian supply sources that you've mentioned. And from what you talk about in the quarterly, I mean, other than LNG, I mean, the pipelines are pretty much at capacity. There's not really much room for manoeuvre there.
There's not. Norwegian flows to the EU continue to be close to their maximum physical capacity of about 250 million cubic metres per day. We're seeing full flows through the Trans-Adriatic pipeline from Azerbaijan. We're seeing some constraints in North African flows, but that seems to be a constraint based on domestic production relative to domestic demand rather than any constraints on the pipelines themselves. But certainly, we don't see much in the way of upside potential. The same goes for European production, which is in the year to date slightly down year on year. That's part of a long-term trend. So again, the only place that you can see any potential upside for non-Russian supply is in LNG. And that obviously is very dependent on any bottlenecks that we might have in European regasification capacity.
And I mean, on the LNG point, I guess one of the points that Mike has been making, and he would make if he were here, is that comparisons year on year get more and more difficult as you go through the year. So again, the upside potential year on year compared to 2021 gets much more limited, doesn't it, in the fourth quarter?
Absolutely. And the simple reason for that is that in the fourth quarter of last year, Europe was already ramping up its LNG imports and in, you know, certain cases of certain regasification terminals hitting full capacity. So I think that if we are going to see a substantial year-on-year increase in European LNG imports, then we need to make hay while the sun shines in the summer, really, because once we get to the fourth quarter, LNG imports could be much flatter year-on-year. Just to give a taster of where we are right now in the year to date, so January to July, European, that is the EU plus UK excluding Turkey, LNG imports are about 83 BCM compared to 52 BCM last year. So we're already up 31 BCM year on year. But I think if that year on year increase is to be expanded upon, then the progress really needs to be made in August and September.
Which is a nice segue into our favourite topic, which is, of course, storage. Indeed, I think we may have to get a T-shirt printed with your face and the storage graph on it, Jack, for the fans of this podcast, because yet again, in the quarterly, you go onto this and you've got some good news and some bad news, I think, and some interesting stats. So what's the good news first?
So the good news is that we are now at 72 BCM of storage stocks, which puts us at 69% of capacity. as a reminder, although I'm sure that the fans and regular listeners to the podcast know full well that the target is 80% of capacity by the 1st of November, which implies stocks of 83 BCM. Now, if we continue injecting, if we want to hit that 83 BCM target, we need to inject another 11 BCM. If we keep injecting at the pace that we have done in the last several months, then actually we can hit that target by the first week of September. Now, of course, things may change during September. It starts to get a little bit chillier. So the seasonal demand profile starts to shift. But I think the good news is that we appear to be very much on track to hit our target, at least of 80% stocks, despite the decline in physical flows from Russia.
Okay, I'm starting to dread to ask what the bad news is, but I'm going to anyway. What's the bad news?
So the bad news is that 80% is really a minimum target. We would actually like to have much more than 80% of storage stocks filled by the start of winter. Having 80% full by the start of winter would simply put us back to where we were at the start of winter 2021. But of course, we benefited from a very mild Q1 in 2021. Whereas I think we have to be prepared for the fact that it might not be so mild in the first quarter of 2023. And so every cubic meter counts. My suspicion is that we will hit the target, but the sooner we hit the target and then inject additional volumes, if you like, the better, so as to make the full use of injection periods in September and October. I think that it's unlikely in September and October that we'll be able to maintain the rate of storage injection that we've seen during the summer. So we're not going to get anywhere near to full stocks of around 100 BCM. My expectation would be that we might get to somewhere between 85 and 90 BCM of stocks with the wind behind us, let's say.
Okay, great. Well, I'm sure we'll follow those numbers on subsequent podcasts and keep up to date with where we are on that percentage. But I think one of the topics that you and particularly Mike have mentioned has been how lucky we've been that imports to China have been down so significantly this year. So I'm delighted to have Mikhail with us on the podcast to talk about Chinese energy consumption, gas consumption, and the outlook for LNG imports. Mikhail, you've written a piece in the Quarterly, which kind of gives a little bit of history and then a kind of bit of a forecast about what you think might happen this winter. Obviously, the zero COVID policy, the lockdowns have had an impact on GDP and overall energy demand. Can you kind of talk us through how we've got to where we are today to start with?
I think there's been a huge amount of debate globally, right, in energy markets about the impact of high prices following the Russian invasion of Ukraine on consumers. And the weak kind of buying footprint in China has been one of those cases where people are looking at it and saying, well, high prices in China isn't buying. The main driver of the buying weakness this year has been the zero COVID policy, which has led to very stringent lockdowns, especially through April and May. There was the very famous Shanghai lockdowns where, 25 million people were essentially at home for around 2 months. But beyond Shanghai, the government's desire to stamp out COVID by essentially curtailing activity at the very first sign of infection has impacted lots of different provinces and lots of different cities at different times of the year. And that really has weighed on economic activity and therefore gas demand. It's important to remember that gas in China is primarily used by industrial and commercial users and to a much lesser degree in the power sector. So again, it's really the kind of health of industry and industrial activity that impacts gas demand. Now, if we rewind even further, it was not a cold winter and China went into the winter relatively well stocked. It doesn't have high storage levels, but what it had was full. So when you add all of that together, LNG buying demand is weak. I mean, if we look at data for the first half of 2022, year on year, gas demand is flat, essentially. But domestic production has been up. Pipeline imports have been up, and really it's in the LNG space where we've seen the big reductions and the big losses.
And as we head towards the party congress in November, and from what I read in your report, the rules around COVID are getting a little less strict. Are we going to see kind of stimulus for the economy? Are we going to see demand, overall energy demand rebounding and gas demand rebounding, do you think?
There's certainly going to be a little bit of an uptick and The Party Congress is extremely important this year. It will take place in October or November. We don't know yet. But because it is Xi Jinping getting a third term, which is unprecedented, everything needs to go smoothly. Now, historically, we've expected to see good economic performance and sort of GDP levels. At the beginning of the year, the government set out a 5.5 GDP growth target for the year. Now, in Q2, GDP growth was 0.4%. And in recent statements, we've sort of heard the government walk back that 5.5%. I mean, they haven't officially walked it back. They've just not been reiterating 5.5, which suggests they're not looking to hit it. And the kind of consensus is we're looking at 3-4% GDP growth now. Government's been issuing infrastructure support and funding. But with the zero COVID dynamics still in place, it is going to be hard to see a very strong stimulus come in again. The rules change between city and province, so even logistically, it's hard to get goods, workers, people from one area to another, and therefore, and especially as we head into the Party Congress, any sign of another flare-up of COVID will lead to, well, either other restrictions, or if China really is loosening up, what we've seen at least in the West is that when you ease control and people do start getting sick, then that weighs on economic activity as well because people are at home. So in any case, it's hard to see a very strong rebound. We are expecting more activity and an improved economic performance and outlook, but it's not going to be kind of a big ticket stimulus like we've seen in the past from China. So that should lead to higher gas demand. And we're probably going to see some year-on-year growth in overall gas demand growth. But for LNG, it will depend very much on the weather. We're seeing a heat wave now in China. So if there is those kind of sporadic increases that really require a strong uptick in LNG demand, potentially some of the issues with coal, perhaps safety inspections and sort of geography related, and we can talk about that in a minute. But a sustained uptick in LNG imports seems unlikely. And so we are looking at a year-on-year fall in LNG imports this year from China.
Okay, I mean, you touched on coal there. I mean, I presume that high gas prices and presumably security supply concerns as well have stimulated coal a little bit. Can you talk about coal? Has it rebounded? Has production rebounded? Has demand rebounded? And is that displacing gas?
Coal production has rebounded significantly, and that's not just post the kind of Russian invasion of Ukraine. This narrative about energy security and coal being the backbone of the Chinese energy system and economy dates back to the power outages last year, but also you can sort of trace it back to 2019 and some of the tensions between the US and China. So coal has been making a steady comeback, and certainly production has increased. But actually this year we've seen a lot more hydropower, and there are kind of stocks of hydro in southern China. We've seen more renewables. So that has in part displaced gas, but really there's not a huge amount of gas to coal switching that takes place in China. I mean, in some provinces it does happen, but gas in the power sector is 6% of installed capacity versus coal, which is 66%. So you can have less gas use where you have more coal, but it is sort of 3-5 BCM up or down that's impacted, but it's not the big driver of the kinds of swings of, you know, we've had 12 BCM less LNG imports year on year this year. That's not all of that is the power sector. Not all of that is coal. I think the availability of coal means less gas in power in the future or a slower uptick in coal to gas switching. But it's not like Europe where you get very quick mechanisms of gas to coal switching on pricing, on where the pricing is. So again, I think it's very much related to the kind of broader economic outlook. And as the economy recovers, we will get more gas demand growth. The China Electricity Council talks about a 7% increase in power demand in the second half of the year. We're looking at 3% increase in the first half of the year. So they are expecting a strong recovery in power demand. But again, how much of that will be gas is probably limited because we have coal, we've got hydropower again this year, and renewables rising strongly.
Okay, so maybe we could just, as we finish, just talk about what would happen in a cold winter. I guess the concern in Europe is about a cold winter. Can you just talk about what might happen in a cold winter in China? I mean, is that going to cause a surge in gas demand?
It could very well cause a surge in gas demand, and not just in gas demand, in LNG specifically. I mean, we wrote a piece earlier this year sort of arguing a big driver for the kind of weak buying was macroeconomic rather than prices. Now, that matters in a winter context, because if China needs the gas, it will buy it, even if it has to compete with Europe. And so if we do get a weather-related increase, and because of the nature of gas demand is very regional, especially gas and power, but also gas and industry, if those regions need those supplies and need that gas, then they will compete for it and they will buy that LNG. Again, it will probably be sporadic. It will depend very much on the weather, but also the other thing to look out for is coal. As I said, there's more coal production, but there have been coal mining accidents and safety incidents. And when those happen, there tends to be a rollout of inspections across the board. The other thing that tends to happen is that ahead of the winter, the government issues a sort of pollution limitations for the winter, so kind of between November and March. And again, they might try and limit coal production. Typically, it comes with industrial curtailments as well. But any signs of major inspections on coal or a very aggressive sort of pollution control measures would also suggest a greater uptick in gas demand this winter.
Okay, great. Well, look, thanks for that. We've come to the end of our time for this podcast, but that was fascinating and clearly highlights the fact that we need to be watching what's happening in Northeast Asia, both in terms of the weather, but also in terms of government policy as well, to get some kind of input into what might be LNG availabilities for Europe in what's clearly going to be a difficult winter there as well. So, Jack, Mikhail, thank you very much indeed for your contributions today. Do look out for the Gas Quarterly, which is on the OIES website today, the 3rd of August. And we'll look forward to speaking to you again soon on another podcast. Thanks very much for listening and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.